Hello, everyone. Joshua Gilliland here with Nari Ely, and we are going to discuss Gamera 1999, Revenge of Iris, the conclusion of the Hezai Gamera trilogy. Nari, how's Washington, D.C. this evening?
Still under the shelter-in-place type order, but of course, there were an unusually high number of people out on the mall yesterday. Number one, because it was fabulous weather. And number two, because there was a flyover by the Blue Angels. I did step outside my apartment to take a look. It was very impressive.
You know, the mall's big. People can space out, you know, like that.
I think it was okay, yeah.
It wasn't
as bad as it sounds at first blush.
It wasn't as bad as the beaches in California or Florida where people are being dumb in Huntington Beach. And yeah, I said it. Orange County had a 22% increase in COVID cases after.
I did hear about that, yeah.
I read the article. I was like, wow, good job, team. Don't be self-entitled. Whew, sorry.
But to sound an optimistic note, what we're doing right now appears to be working. Most of the states, the best estimates right now is that most of the states are starting to be on the downward side of the trend. So not to say we need to all stop what we're doing, but just that what we're doing has been working, which is, you know, it should feel better to know that it's effectual.
Yeah, if it wasn't working, that would be bad.
That would be a good sign that maybe we should reconsider our actions.
But the fact it's... We've slowed it. Sure, we've only passed the horrific milestone of the same number of people who died in Vietnam in our 7 years of war there, met that number in 3 months. So again.
And it's important to remember that those are largely reasonably considered additional deaths, yeah. Right? There's a lot of people who die in the United States every year and things like that. But this is undoubtedly causing a large number of additional deaths. So just to clarify that.
Yeah. Yes, all horrible, and this is how we deal with it, by talking about it, because...
Yes, and by podcasting with you, Josh. Thanks again for inviting me.
Always a pleasure, because it's always fun to talk about giant monsters, which can be an allegory for what we're experiencing.
Yes.
Revenge of Iris is a massive allegory for what's happening with COVID-19, and we'll talk about that as we get into the analysis. So, just to give people an idea, it's now 1999, and it's August. We actually have screens with dates, and it's funny, I was in law school at this time, and Nari, where were you in August of 1999?
I was 9 years old, and I may have been visiting my grandparents in Korea, actually.
Nice, and I don't feel at all old hearing that. So. Oh God, the Wonder Years music starts playing. So, which is a reference you might not understand.
Only distantly, sorry.
Once there was an actor named Fred Savage. And so let's talk about some of the public policy of where we are at this time.
Yes. Because yeah, we've now been in the world, or the universe that Gamera exists in, right? Japan / the world has been living with and experiencing kaiju attacks for a number of years now. In fact, as a lot of the scenes show during the movie, there's a certain amount of normalcy or jadedness attached to some of this. You know, people being interviewed on the street about the Gauss and things like that and not reacting with confusion and alarm. there's been some time for this to kind of set in and to change the way that people view the world.
Yes, and as we discussed last time, probably insurance has changed. You know, have common carriers changed? Do airplanes have like Gauss avoidance systems now? Like what are we doing? And if the film begins in the Tsuburaya, I'm probably saying that wrong, district in Tokyo, and Gamera shoots down one Gauss, and it is so...
A big one.
And it's eyes hanging out, it's like been burned badly. People are running because, again, you have a giant flying monster
Flaming also. Flaming flying monster. Because it has been lit on fire.
Yeah, and Gamera lands, walks through some buildings, and finishes off one, and then kills another by shooting it through a building with people in it. So that's not good on a few levels, especially for the people who were collateral damage in that fight. And people are rightfully upset because there's 20,000 casualties. Doesn't mean fatalities, but there's around 20,000 casualties in Tokyo. And we get this weird reaction of everyone focuses on Gamera. They ignore Gauss.
Yeah.
And that, there's a good there's a good comparison to COVID-19 of people ignoring the disease that's killing people and say, I want to go to the beach, or I'm going to go put on my warrior cosplay and storm the Michigan Capitol protesting shelter in place, when that body armor and your AR-15 is not going to stop the virus. Why do you need that for your First Amendment rights, bucko? But
right, and to put it as charitably as possible, there's, you know, a non-trivial, you know, you should be thinking about what are the costs of what we're doing. There's economic hardship. There may be a certain amount of death or bodily harm that's caused by this, and like increased domestic violence and depression and things like that. But it has to be a reasoned analysis, and focusing only on the hardship or harms that you can readily observe that are right in front of you, and that may be imposed by your government officials. You know, it's not ridiculous, but if you myopically focus on that alone and don't consider what is the cause of this situation or what is the alternative, then that's where you run into some problems. And this is what we see in Gamera Revenge of Iris, is the immediate, right in front of your face harm, which was Gamera landing in the middle of a crowded city district and causing 20,000 casualties. You know, I understand that that's a big deal and that it's difficult to ignore that, and you probably shouldn't, but do you focus on that myopically? Do you focus on that to the exclusion of everything else that might be causing that, or, you know, the alternatives of getting rid of Gamera, or trying at least to get rid of Gamera? That's where you run into some problems.
Because Gamera is killing the Gauss that would otherwise be eating people. So
It was made pretty clear in movie one that if the Gauss were running around unrestricted by Gamera, uncountered by Gamera, it would be an extinction event.
Yeah, so they seem to be forgetful of that. You know, you know, they probably live in a world where you can't sunbathe on a beach anymore.
Not without very serious personal risk, yes.
And if people are complaining about, I want to go sunbathe on the beach, and they go sunbathe on the beach, and then they end up as Gauss snacks, just picked off one by one off rooftops if they're up there sunbathing, if by the swimming pool, if they're there sunbathing, you know, if they're now just snacks, and they still just complain about, how dare you infringe on my right to go get a suntan? It's like, dude, you're missing the point of what's
Well, so actually, Josh, to me, it looks like the Japan in which Gamera Revenge of Iris is set does appear to be a Japan which has largely stuck its head in the sand. Most of the scenes of life that are depicted in the movie, and especially leading up to this, you know, sudden Gamera landing and Gauss crash, are extremely normal. And it's very weird to have an extremely normal looking busy Tokyo life in a world in which, again, there are regular attacks by Gauss. And it's hinted at the beginning and throughout the movie that the rest of the world is having very serious problems with Gauss. You know, why should it be normal? And it's very odd that it does seem to be that there is no official restrictions, and there have been no cultural changes. For example, why are you still all living in crowded city centers?
Yeah, let's spread out, and every street gets a phalanx anti-missile system to shoot down a Gauss if it tries.
Right, where even just the basic procedures of, like, you know, I think, so I think we're both maybe a little too young to have lived through this, but the, you know, the drills that they would do for nuclear attacks, like where you're supposed to run, dive under your desk, that kind of stuff. There's no protocol that people are aware of in this scene for what you do when there is a kaiju attack. And again, this is a regular occurrence in this universe.
Yeah, it's, I did earthquake drills. But
right. Yes, California.
You know, by the time I was in elementary school in the 1980s, we might have just accepted that if we take a nuclear hit, we're done.
My understanding is the diving under the desk was actually just to make you feel better.
Yeah, that was more in the 50s. By the time Reagan's in office, we knew that we'd be vaporized. So it's why we wanted the Strategic Defense Initiative to shoot down ICBMs coming our way. And I still think that's a good thing, especially with North Korea. But
we digress.
Treat the problem. Don't complain about the solution to it.
Right. And the solution in this situation might have really sucked, like needing to move people out of their homes, needing to get people to spread out or practice all of these drills for a kaiju attack. I'm sure that'd be annoying. I get annoyed whenever I need to do a fire drill for my apartment building. but it's probably necessary. The alternative, as we can see, is much worse in this movie.
Yeah, you don't, if there's a fire, you'll want to know where the stairs are.
Yeah, yeah.
As opposed to, like, oh, what are we supposed to do? Oh,
I think, God, we're supposed to go to the window and watch what Gamera does when he opens his mouth.
That was your plan? That was your plan. You got out the camera. Okay. Good job. Darwin at work. So.
And I would like to refer anyone who's listening and didn't listen to Gamera, our podcast about Gamera 1 and 2, that we talk a lot about shelter in place orders, about evacuation orders, and different things like that. And so please go check those out if you have specific thoughts about those.
Yes, good plug. So let's talk about the facts here are a girl who in 1995 had to have her appendix out, and thus her parents didn't follow the mandatory evacuation order. And Gamera and Gauss land on their neighborhood, and Gamera walks through their apartment building and her parents are killed.
Right.
So she blamed...
Oh, wait, was it Gauss, or I thought it was Legion?
No, it was Gauss. It was Gauss.
Oh, okay.
So
this is all the way back to Gamera 1, right? This is a flashback, yeah.
Flashback to Gamera 1. So it's not Legion. And she has to go live with her aunt and uncle and cousin. And she blames Gamera for the fact that her parents died, and not the fact that they ignored the mandatory evacuation order. And it's bad, because at least the little brother was sent away. It's like, mom could have gone. Like, dad could have stayed and waited for the kid to get out of surgery. But no, both parents decided to wait. And the fight comes to their neighborhood after the missile attack has begun. So it's a really weird... her sense of revenge is misplaced.
Yeah, I can understand it as just an emotional thing, right? Her home getting destroyed, and Gamera is the thing that she sees, you know, standing over the smoldering ruins. I can understand that. It's and the fact that she is a young adult makes me a little more sympathetic, right? It's as you get older, you should be able to start separating out your emotions from, you know, your actual logical conclusions about these kinds of things. I would assume, you know, if she were an older person in this movie, I would find her a far less sympathetic figure. I already find her a slightly unsympathetic figure. But yeah, we would assume that she would hopefully grow out of this eventually.
Yeah, and not just be mean emo girl who hates everyone.
I know, she cut quite the figure, didn't she?
It just, you know, just mean.
Resented the family that took her in. Yeah, it wasn't great.
No, none of it good. And for some reason, there's a boy that likes her. And
you know, for some reason, I also am mystified.
Was your mom mean to you? So this is why you want to be around the mean girl? I mean, do you? Yeah, it's problematic. It's just
you want mommy issues. I do like that.
You got to go talk to him. It's like, she hates you. Why do you want to save her? And is that
she clearly does not respect him. No. So there's this whole sequence of events, right, where she's dared to go into the shrine, this, you know, cave area. And she does go in, and then after she goes in, he follows her in and convinces her to leave, put the stone back and explains that, you know, this is a sacred place. My family is the guardian of this place. You must not go in. And she just ignores it and goes right back.
Yeah, because she.
So there's clearly no respect there.
Yeah, and it's so messed up because she either wants something that can exact revenge on Gamera for her, so that's creepy and wrong on numerous levels, or she just has a death wish of, no, I want to go do this, and I want to raise the creepy thing in the egg and hope it all works out okay to my benefit. That's,
it looked very weird. So Iris, when it first hatches, it looks pretty creepy. It looks pretty weird. I, you know, as a lifelong Star Trek fan, I am sympathetic to the idea that you should not judge things by the way they first appear. It makes a few cute noises, seems at first to be harmless. The point at which I part company with Ayana is when it reveals that it has a stinger that will suck things dry. That was pretty creepy.
Yeah, that means it's a predator, that it's gonna go kill things. And how big is it going to get? She's not thinking about all of those considerations. And ultimately, it gets big after it's killed a bunch of animals and then envelops her. So we get like some weird tentacle stuff going on because that's a thing.
Yes. And
it's a real horrible thing. And she's in this like cocoon sack deal, fusing with the creature, and has all of these.
In some poorly explained way, yes.
All of these like giant artery tentacle things connected to her back, which really had to leave a mark because it's.
Yeah.
So Hero Boy, to his credit, doesn't say like, you're on your own, honey. I warned you. Now look what you did. He didn't like dust his hands off and leave. He pulled her out of it and
cut her out of it. Yes.
Yeah, cut her out of it.
There was some work involved here.
There was goo. There was sick goo.
So gross, Josh. It was so gross.
It's nightmare inducing. It's right up there with aliens, you know, type of people walled up and things bursting out their chests. Think that.
I was also thinking John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yeah, that too. It's everything gross in sci-fi is basically happening to her with a tentacle element to it. It's not okay. She's kind of comatose for a little bit. So we get lots of issues. So we got...
Yes, our first true legal issues here.
So one of the big legal issues is we have this occultist working for the government who's
partner... In some very, again, ill-explained way.
Yeah, so she has some government position and seems to be in a death cult. And then we have a creepy software guy that's very 1990s creepy software guy.
Oh, so for sure.
It was my memory of guys who did coding in college. So, like, that version of antisocial, does not interact well with other people, types really fast, has an aloof look, just seems out there, tad creepy. It needs a haircut, all of those. And made a video game about, it was like weather predictions or
hold on. I want us to make sure that we make clear video game here is in scare quotes.
Yeah, it's...
It's not clear to me at all how this is a game.
Yeah, I think it's a program. Yeah, that does not sound like something fun on the Sega Dreamcast. It's like, what?
No. I think this is supposed to have been translated perhaps to program.
Yeah. But when we see our favorite science girl, it's like a Sega Dreamcast or something along one of those video game platforms from the late 90s that the CD-ROMs put into. So it's...
Yeah, I don't know. But it's pretty clear it's no fun.
No, it's just, this is a video game about math. Are you
kidding? Yeah. Statistical analysis, yes. That's actually what they said. Yes. I took statistical analysis in college. I do not think I played any games.
No, that sounds like as fun as duct tape on your eyebrows. It just does not. Who wants in? Who's ready? Kids.
Only do it if you're going to get paid. That's what I say.
Yeah, it's just, nope, uh-uh. even the Patreon rate on that one would be pretty high because it does not sound like a fun time for me. But that's what we have here. And after she's rescued and she's comatose in the hospital, creepy programmer and amorphous government official get her out of the hospital and take her to Kyoto. And there are some serious issues with taking a comatose minor that they're not related to out of the hospital. And our heroes, when they get to the hospital, outright accuse the doctor of, like, that's kidnapping. What's your problem, dude? And let's analyze that. Whether or not it's kidnapping, maybe false imprisonment later when they take her to the really creepy medical facility. I'm going to use air quotes, medical facility.
Yeah, it looks to me like a dark room in a basement.
In like the cheap hotel.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like, so again, and yes, we have our machines here. And she's connected to them. It's like, it does not bode well for this is a licensed medical facility with
doctors. I know, their defense lawyer is going to not have an easy time with that case.
It's like, can I see the photos? Oh, crap. I mean, what would you think? God damn it. You know,
like, Your Honor, I move to strike the photos. On what grounds? They're terrible for my client.
They are super prejudicial because it makes them look like horrible people, Your Honor.
Yeah.
It's just
for the benefit of our viewers, I will just note that is not valid grounds to withhold something from the jury. Anyway, moving on.
Your Honor, it's too relevant.
Exactly. If something is yet basic 40, I think this is 401 analysis here, is that it's prejudicial and not probative. No, it's 403. That's right. 401 is relevance. 403. That's right. Is unduly prejudicial and not probative.
And it looks like you have your science dungeon. Things aren't going well, and this looks like a science dungeon. So, is that kidnapping? Is it? You know, like, let's break down the issues. So, like, the first one is there has to be a guardianship appointed.
Right, for this to be an appropriate release of a minor into custody of an adult.
You can't just, the fact that the doctor says all their paperwork was in order, it's like, what paperwork, dude? Was there a appointing, like, mystery official?
They presented him with a handwritten note on a napkin.
Mystery official is not what Child Protective Services is. Like,
right.
It's just...
We're not entirely clear on what Miss Asakura's job is in the government, but it is pretty clear it is not social services or child protective services.
Yeah, none of which is good. Like, this is not... this would be like, maybe like the DOD taking a kid. You know, it's like, what just happened? Like, that's not okay. They don't just come there and go like, we're from the Department of Defense. We need this child. what? You know, or, yeah. Or again, pick the alphabet agency. You know, we're ATF. We're here for the child. No.
Well, so, and here's the other thing, is that if it were, again, I'm trying to think of, we're in, you know, a kaiju universe where crazy things happen, you know, I can imagine the DOD does show up and says, truthfully, it is a matter of national security, we must have custody of the child. I mean, crazier stuff has happened in the Gamera universe, right? I'm blanking on her name now, but Asagi and her connection to Gamera. There are situations in which government officials might show up and ask for you to release the child to them. And it's possible that the hospital was not, you know, wrong not to resist when the DOD shows up and flashes a badge and says, we're taking the child. But that's different from they had the right paperwork.
Your Honor, she clearly had a magic amulet. It was right for the Defense Department to take her. No. Like,
yeah.
Graft children. What are you doing? What, you know, like, this is not the right course of action for a government official just to take a kid. And only that, this would be federal government, not like state.
Right. And like, you can imagine a slightly mundane but alarming example would be somebody shows up with some paperwork in order to take custody of a child out of a hospital, and it turns out that they're not from the government, or they represent that they're the child's parent, and it turns out that they're not the child's parent. These are, you know, real considerations for which, you know, we rightfully have very strong concerns in our law and policy about.
Yeah, it's, yeah, that's a big oopsie-do of, we let the creepy software dude and the nefarious government, we're not sure from where, agent, take a kid.
Right. I did try to look it up and I wasn't able to locate, but I know that, for example, I was able to locate, there are laws in California, and I assume every state, governing, for example, who a school or a child care provider is allowed to release children to. So I presume, although I wasn't able to locate the statutes, but that there are codes in pretty much every state that govern the same thing when it comes to medical providers and hospitals releasing minors into the custody of adults.
Yes. And we do have some serious kidnapping rules, which
yes.
do come into play here, because there could be issues of fraud. But just looking at California law, you know, there's a special section for minors. And like, you know, somebody who's not a relative of a kid, you know, and zero legal custody, you know, there's an enhancement feature to the punishment where the, you know, the incarceration time shall not be less than 20 years. So at mm-hmm. a minimum, the person would get 20 years.
I believe under the statute that you found, Josh, the maximum was death or life imprisonment, right?
Yes, absolutely. Again.
So minimum 20 years up to the rest of your life, including by execution.
Because again, we're kind of sensitive about, you took a kid, which, you know, I grew up in the age when, you know, then it was Assemblyman Gray Davis, future governor who got thrown out. He was the one who came up with the pictures of kids on milk cartons. And
oh.
Yeah. Well, I was in that first generation and none of us wanted to end up on a milk carton. So like, we yeah. were all pretty, nope, don't want to be that one. And that's the situation. Like, this is not okay. This is, it's just not okay, because she ends up in a science dungeon with people who want to bring about the end of the world. This is why we have laws on why you can't just take a kid out of the hospital.
Yeah. By the way, I did look up the DC code about this. It uses very similar language to the California one, not surprising, and provides for, except in the case of a minor, imprisonment for not more than 30 years. If it is in the case of a minor, I'm trying to check, I haven't found the specific one in the case of a minor, but I presume it's also similarly enhanced.
Yeah, they just, we don't like this, do not like it. But now let's talk a little bit more about what happens, because Ayana, you know, kids get into trouble, but few fuse with a giant monster and goes around killing people.
Only one that we know.
Hopefully this is a rare occurrence and we don't develop a body of case law on another kid got into Satan worship and, well, things got a little weird on the neighborhood. That yeah, hope not. But she is communicating with Iris the same way that we saw in Gamera 1 with our hero communicating with Gamera. And the doctors discuss a diagnosis with her that the hippocampus in her brain and
hippocampus,
both sides were swollen.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctors...
They weren't able to explain why, but they were observing it.
Yes. And that does address or is connected to the formation of new memories, and it's associated both with learning and emotions.
Mm-hmm.
So this is going to be important because Ayana realizes, oops-a-doo, Iris killed my aunt, uncle, and cousin, and half the people in the town. And through when Iris tries connecting.
It ate them.
Like, sucked the life out of them.
Yeah.
It's like dried.
It's not an accident. Like, it's big and strong and it knocked them over. No, it ate them.
Fed upon their life.
Yeah.
And she's.
Their precious bodily fluids.
Very Dr. Strangelove. but you can see, she's able to see her family get killed through.
Yeah. Towards the end of the movie, she sees through the eyes of Iris those events, those acts.
Yes. So we have some issues with, could we have the insanity defense apply to her if she was going to be charged with the murder of half her town?
Right.
And
not setting aside all of the other mass destruction, but just specifically the very visceral, very personal slayings in her village.
Yeah, because we have to survive that first before we get to you destroy the town.
Yeah,
that's a big one. Nari, do you want to walk us through the analysis on, well, how this would work?
Sure. So it partly depends on which test is being applied. So the insanity defense has changed over the years. I did a little research, and it turns out that the insanity defense dates back to at least the Code of Hammurabi, which is kind of insane. It's the first codified law that we know of in history. But to quickly describe it in very rough strokes, though, or very broad strokes, the insanity defense is essentially an affirmative defense. So we're past the point where you've stood trial. So this can get confused sometimes with the argument or the defense that you should not be allowed to stand trial because you're mentally unfit for that. And that's a separate thing. That rests on, you know, are you fit enough to raise your own defense, communicate with your counsel, that kind of stuff. This one is instead an affirmative defense. It's supposed to negate or excuse your culpability with respect to your act of killing someone. Now, there's a few ways to look at it, and I think you have a little more experience with what's called the irresistible impulse test, so I can let you briefly describe what that is. But the basic gist of it is that there was originally something called the McNaughton rules, which looked at whether or not you were incapable of either appreciating the criminality of your act, or the wrongness of your act, or were unable to appreciate the nature or quality of the act that you were committing. There was also a more generous or liberal test. I don't know if that's the right word for it, but a little more broad test that came after that called the Durham test, which was focused instead on, was your insanity, your mental affliction, the but-for cause of your criminal act? So, you know, would you not have committed this murder except that you had this mental affliction? And then I think finally where we ended up is somewhere a little bit in between that, which in the model penal code refers to a defendant is not responsible for criminal conduct, quote, if at the time of such conduct as a result of mental disease or defect, he lacks substantial capacity either to appreciate the criminality of his conduct or to conform his conduct to the requirements of law. So that ends up borrowing bits and pieces of all of the tests that I mentioned, including, Josh, if you want to tell us really briefly, what's the irresistible impulse test?
Short answer is they can't stop it. You can't control it.
And right. It just, as opposed to, I didn't know what I was doing. I may have known what I was doing, but I was helpless to stop it.
Exactly. So there's, you know, like we got rid of that in California. So the issue is, do you understand the wrongfulness of your actions?
Mm-hmm.
And one of, if you really dig back far into our catalog, long ago, Jessica and I did a podcast about the assassination of President Garfield, which got into this big time. And that one, Gitteru, who shot President Garfield, was one crazy SOB. But and the trial is big. And like, so we discussed it at length already. But the punchline is the jury convicted him in like 30 minutes with a death sentence. Like they were, and like he fired his legal team, tried defending himself for a bit. So
oh, yeah. I do not know this story, and I deeply regret it.
Oh, it's wild. And everyone realized, you know, like the view was, no, he cray-cray, but he knows right from wrong. So you can be delusional in mind, but still understand the wrongfulness of your actions. And
right.
And the fact that he hesitated before shooting Garfield showed that he understood that what he was doing was wrong.
Right.
So, and he was hung quickly thereafter. We did not mess around. You know, it's one of those things, shooting a president really ticks us off. You know, like, and this was, you know, this was 1881. And, you know, the country, like Lincoln had been assassinated, but we didn't get a trial there.
Right.
So Booth was killed in a barn house burning down. And this is one of the times when a president was, after being assassinated, there was a trial. Didn't get that with Kennedy. I think we got that with McKinley, but we did not get, you know, but again, you know, like we there are two big exceptions where trials don't happen. But we did here, and it was, they understood the wrongfulness. So when we look at Ayanna, does she understand the wrongfulness of her actions? And that's where things get weird, because you could argue that the medical evidence shows that she had a brain abnormality because of her connection to Iris. And she was acting kind of in a fugue state until she gets the little cut on her face from the knife during the final battle with Iris, which snaps
the knife, which is supposed to have special powers to seal Iris.
Yeah, I think the special power was stab it while it's small.
Yeah.
Any big knife will do.
Kill it while you can!
Just stab it repeatedly until it stops moving. You've done your job, but you gotta wait for it to hatch. But the goal is for it to not to hatch. We clear? Okay. Does she understand the wrongfulness of her actions? And I think there's a good argument that she did not, until she got snapped out of it by getting the little cut on her face. Because then she wakes up from the fugue state.
So, but here's an interesting question about, did she, it's important to distinguish because, you know, I read off the definition of the model penal code. It's not the version that's enacted in every state. So this might vary depending on who, you know, which jurisdiction is trying Ayanna. Is this more under the definition of she didn't understand that what she was doing was wrong, or is this more under the view of she didn't understand what exactly it was she was doing? It's not clear to me that she understands the extent to which she is partaking in or even controlling Iris's actions. I think that might be one of the stronger elements if that's part of the insanity defense in the in the relevant jurisdiction, right? And it may not be. But to just explain the distinction, this is, for example, in an insanity defense in which your reason for insanity or the nature of your insanity was not that you lacked the capacity to understand that killing this person was wrong or that shooting this person was wrong, but that you lacked the understanding that the thing you were holding was not a TV remote, but it was a gun. And I think that might be a stronger argument for Ayanna, but it may or may not be available to her as an insanity defense. Because she definitely does not seem to understand until she sees through the eyes of Iris and asks herself, was it me doing these things, that she was, either influencing or even controlling Iris when it was doing these things. And that's a distinct possibility. I understand that you mentioned as, evidence that Garfield's assassin understood the wrongfulness of his hesitation. And I think that, in this case, you're definitely on point there with Ayanna, because at no point during these scenes do we see her reconsider, think about it, hesitate. I agree that she seems mostly to be in a trance type state. But it's difficult for me to understand, because there's so little articulation of her thinking during these scenes, if she really doesn't understand at these moments that killing people is bad or that eating people is bad.
Yeah, she might be so obsessed with her hatred of Gamera that she's just being used by Iris, that Iris is feeding off her hatred to sustain itself.
Is it feeding off of her hatred, or is she influencing it with her hatred?
And from the mythology that they find, possibly both is the answer, because it's when they deal with the ancient scrolls that they find, that there is a little bit of the mysticism there that this was a bad entity.
Well, there's some unanswered questions with the scrolls. So it is not affirmatively resolved, although I think we can reasonably draw some conclusions, but it's not affirmatively resolved whether Iris is the guardian of the South, which fell, or whether it is the thing that felled the guardian of the South. I lean towards, when we first finished watching it, I lean towards the idea that it was the thing that killed the Guardian of the South. But it's possible also that because it does this intense melding, which seems to be, as you mentioned, much grosser and much deeper than the meld that the mind link that Gamera had with Asagi, it is also possible that it is the Guardian of the South, but that it has fallen. And it is overly influenced by these dark human emotions and impulses that Ayanna might be feeding to it.
I think the way that it feeds upon people, it's not a guardian.
No, you're probably right. I was just making my best case that I could here.
Yeah, because I think there's the big issue of it feeds on people. Gamera doesn't eat people.
Does Gamera eat? We haven't actually seen him eat. He's powered by the nuclear reactor, isn't he? Or plutonium or something? I believe in the first movie they talk about that.
Yeah, in the original series, they have him absorbing fire and radiation. Mm-hmm.
And he does do that, and I'm including in this movie to great effect.
So, but we don't see him snack.
We don't see him use his mouth for anything other than defeating Gauss and other invading kaiju.
Yeah, he's not eating on beluga whale or anything like that, which would probably kill
the people. He also doesn't eat the Gauss that he barbecues.
Nope, they did. And Gauss, he's the exterminator. It's what he does.
But yeah, to get back to the insanity defense, though, and I think it might be helpful because you pulled up some of this discussion of the policy behind the insanity defense, right? Why even have it? So I mentioned that this dates back to the Code of Hammurabi. So there's clearly something fundamental in here about what we think about culpability. But what are some policy reasons, Josh, why we might allow this kind of defense to even be available?
Well, we're a civil society. And the idea of executing somebody who's not mentally right goes against that. You know, that doesn't excuse them for what they did. And if you're not guilty by reason of insanity, that doesn't mean that you just go free. That's, you know, you end up like John Hinckley, which is also part of the reason why people get upset about the insanity defense, because there's a certain degree of revenge that people want with law enforcement. And again, that's not justice. Don't confuse revenge for justice. Just because we throw somebody away to be held in prison for the rest of their lives doesn't mean that we torture them. It doesn't mean that, you know, we were barbaric. You know, they go away for a reason.
There's definitely a retributive aspect to criminal justice, but at least in our version of criminal justice that we've had dating back to English common law, it is certainly not the only policy that we're furthering or value goal that we're furthering through the criminal justice system. You know, one of them is incapacitation, another one is rehabilitation, all of these things. And I also want to highlight that, so insanity is one affirmative defense that you can raise when you're charged with murder. Another well-known one that I've mentioned in previous podcasts, just to kind of compare it to in order to understand why we consider there to be reduced culpability depending on your mental state, is temporary mental states, such as the defense to downgrade from first degree to second degree, which is different from insanity. Insanity is trying to negate or excuse the act more entirely than what we would call a temporary insanity or a temporary mental state. And those involve crimes of passion, right? So either because, let's say, you were fleeing law enforcement even, or pursuing someone who had just committed a crime against you or someone else, or you walk in on your cheating spouse, right? These are all prototypical kinds of scenarios where we as people just kind of understand and accept that it inflicts a temporary mental state under which we might do things that if we had more time to think about it, and the period is having a cooling off period, the term is cooling off period, we might not do, and that we bear less moral culpability, but we're not absolved of moral culpability when we undertake those acts under that mental state. And you can make a little bit of a longer term, usually more systemic argument when you're talking about insanity defense, but it's grounded on similar principles, that if someone is under this kind of mental state, even possibly a permanent condition under which they cannot appreciate what they're doing or cannot appreciate the moral implications of what they're doing, we find it less culpable.
Yeah, to bring in some case law quotes, now, one is punishment for dealing with somebody who is not sound of mind when they committed an act, but competent to stand trial, is punishment for such a defendant would be both unjust and futile, because we're not deterring future conduct, because that requires some sanity.
Right.
And simply, well, you know, we didn't like them, so we decided to just put them away in prison or execute someone who's not right in the head. Again, that's barbaric. Another quote is, the insanity defense serves to distinguish those who would be punished for those who lack sufficient capacity to merit punishment. In brief, the insanity defense separates the sick from the bad. Right. And I think Ayanna can fall into the category of the sick. She clearly needs therapy and has some revenge issues that need to be addressed because she hates Gamera. But I think there's a strong argument she didn't understand the wrongfulness of her actions when her family was killed by Iris.
Right.
And that's still applying that she still had some control and influence over Iris and the death of her family members.
Right.
And the rest of her town. And the one friend... There's one friend girl that we're not sure if she died or not.
Yeah, she just never shows up again. We know that it's a 50-50 chance because half the village was killed, but...
Yeah, they were still IDing the bodies. So again, that's... Yeah. But we see her immediate family, with the exception of her brother, get taken out. And that's they all die horribly. So it's just they.
Yeah, and I think her little brother was spared because he went with her to the hospital, right?
Yes.
So it wasn't that he was in the house and Iris spared him.
No, he was at the. He was safe. He avoided the Gamma incident and he avoided the Iris incident. So, yeah, a lot there. So. That's the key legal analysis from the film. Part of my joy in watching this was gauging your reactions. And we're going to...
I think that's true of all three Gamera movies.
Yeah. So which is your favorite of the three?
So I know you said your favorite, or you heard someone say that their favorite, depending on their mood, might be either two or three.
Yeah.
I think my favorites, depending on my mood, are either one and two. And here's my reason. So the second one definitely, I think, has more in the way of incredible monster fights, right? And I think, strictly speaking, the third has the most in terms of incredible kaiju fights, for sure. But the second has more in the way of that. It also has... it does not partake in the very frustrating narrative of both one and two of maybe we should kill Gamera first, which the Japanese government in movies one and three seems very predisposed to trend towards. Working with Gamera in the second movie was quite refreshing. However, I do think that Gamera 1, Gamera Guardian of the Universe, holds a very special place in my heart, in particular because I think it does the most work in terms of developing the characters. And in fact, some of my favorite moments from movies 2 and 3 are when those same characters return, either even for brief appearances, like in Gamera 2 when the security guard / former police detective shows up for the scene in the warehouse. And then again in Gamera 3, when kick-ass science girl and, again, former police detective, washed-up police detective, return for long storylines. And Gamera 1 really makes those into very lovable characters that I'm always happy to see return.
I understand that. And, again, I do love all three. I do think Legion is my favorite overall, because it's the military and Gamera do work together.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the problem solving that takes place in it and the way other characters from the original return. You know, they're not just, you know, it's a giant monster movie, but they're not just rehashing the giant monster. You know, they're, you know, like things happen that are different. Things move forward. And then the third one, I do think the third one has the best final fight, and I'll explain why I feel that way, but it's a more intimate story. Instead of seeing the giant military battle, it's an intimate fight in an enclosed space, and they're fighting over the soul of a kid. And on that, it's pretty brilliant, because it's different. Instead of, you know, like, we're not just going to have the military show up and we have F-15s backing up Gamera. It's Gamera one-on-one. Most of this town has evacuated out and the monsters are fighting in a train station.
In what I understand to be the Japanese equivalent of, for example, Grand Central Station. I don't recognize it, but I can tell it is a well-recognized landmark.
I don't think that's happened in any other kaiju movie, or at least none that I've seen. And granted, there are hundreds of these that I haven't seen. So they're but it's a giant enclosed space.
Yeah.
And that gives it a completely different feel for the two of them just slugging it out.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they slug it out,
Which, by the way, quite literal. There's a lot of, Gamera literally does quite a bit of slugging here.
So there was one moment when I first saw this, I actually yelled, "Dude," because it was such a shock. And you did make a noise.
Yes. I think my exact reaction was somewhere between a what and a squeal.
Yeah, it just... phenomenal. Because again, you're not expecting it.
No, not at all.
so that, I mean, that flame punch is brilliant. I mean, the entire Gamera shooting off his own hand.
Right, starting with that, which was shocking to me as well.
the costume in this, the look on his face, the eyes convey emotion.
Mm-hmm.
And not every suit does that. And this does it remarkably well. But him shooting off his own hand and then gut punching Irish with the flaming fist is hell yeah. I mean, the other.
Oh, also, speaking of gut punches.
The first one.
Yes, his first gut punch is literally punching Iris through the gut and then grabbing his guts.
To Ayana, who's in there and like getting absorbed,
right?
Like, we're in there with her, and she says, "I'm falling. Somebody help me,
mm-hmm.
please." And you, from inside of Iris, from her perspective, you see Gamera's hand claw punch through,
yep.
and grab her. I mean, like, watching in slow motion, you can actually see the fist. It is so good.
Yeah, it was incredible. And I agree, there is something very special about that narrative. You know, in particular, you know, first by putting a human face on the collateral damage that we've seen in both movies 1 and 2. Secondly, in terms of, you know, Gamera, in a very personal way, as he just mentioned, with this hand literally reaching out of the void, rescuing this girl who had made it her life's mission to destroy him, to kill him.
Yeah, all on the line to save her. So again, how do you make a giant monster movie intimate to the human experience? This movie does that, and that is so rare for that to happen. So again, I do love this film. And again, that the last fight scene, because of it's a mix of brutality, intimacy, it's about one person. That's exceptional. Share your reaction to the command room with the general getting the phone call from the director or prime minister.
Oh my God. So yeah, so towards the end, so again, as I mentioned earlier, throughout the movie, you're getting these little breadcrumbs and hints that things are not going well in the world in terms of the sort of global fight of humanity versus Gauss. Planes are disappearing. The United States Air Force has been occupied fighting an unknown enemy. Things of that nature. And towards the end of the movie, after this epic fight with Iris, the command center gets a call that a large number of Gauss have been spotted flying towards Tokyo. They get a warning from the US and Russia and China and other actors who are definitely inclined to give Japan a heads up. Sarcasm intended there. But in any event, he gets the call and he says to the room, a large number of Gauss are headed towards Japan. The question is asked, well, how many? And he just listens on the phone and just says, a lot. And then the scene immediately following is basically a sky being blackened by Gauss approaching Japan, which I think perfectly highlights that one of the underlying issues in this movie, perhaps intended to be resolved in a fourth movie, which never happened, but was that Japan essentially decided somewhere between Gamera 2 and 3 to stick its head in the sand, to let the rest of the world deal with the Gauss, perhaps through a too literal interpretation of Article 9 of their constitution, as we've discussed in reference to Gamera 1 and 2. There's actually a reference at one point when a woman is being interviewed just off the street for her thoughts, as I think Japan should be doing more, we shouldn't be letting the US handle all of this. And that appears to be literally the hens coming home to roost at the end of this movie, by turning inwards and by trying to ignore anything that extended beyond their shores, they now have a problem that they might not be able to handle.
Yeah, it's a good wake-up call against isolationism, or
yeah,
you can't just ignore a problem. And again, this is where COVID-19 plays the role of, you don't blame Gamera for the Gauss problem. You got to take care of the Gauss problem. And right. you should only
start this, you know, as despite the fact that the Japanese government never does this, they should really only think about turning their guns on Gamera if he's rampaging and there's no Gauss. You got to think about the alternatives.
Yeah, it's just like, well, he's hopeful. You know, it's you know, they haven't put anti-aircraft guns on top of buildings to shoot down the flying birds that eat people. Like, they're not dealing with the problem. And it's like, did you guys put in bomb shelters? I mean,
right, exactly.
It's like, there used to be some. Might need to break those, you know, go do some remodeling, because if there's a Gauss attack, going underground is a good way to not be on the street to be a meal.
Yeah.
But you got to deal with the problem. And I do love the final message as we see Gamera walking through the flames, missing a hand, the hell, having been impaled. And, you know, the final message of Gamera will fight to the end, even if it's alone.
Yeah. And
I love that. I love that message of, we're going to do this. And the movie ends, but Gamera's fight doesn't.
Mm-hmm. You know, yeah, and I liked, though, I did ask you if they intended to make a fourth movie, but I liked your response that whether or not they intended to, the note on which they end and the message that it sends is quite good in its own right.
Yeah, it's defense never ends. That we're here, you know, it's like, we can't say like, well, we defeated the Soviet Union, we're fine, the world is safe, all is well now. So, you know, we don't live in that world. We live in a world where you have to take action and you can't just wish a problem away. And, you know, Gamera is an allegory for that.
Yep, definitely.
But yes, this has been fun, and I'm glad we could share this together, because this is, I think, hands down one of the best kaiju stories ever. And yeah, so closing thoughts.
Just that I really appreciate that. So for people probably don't know, but I actually I watched these through a live stream that Josh provided to me, because it's a little difficult to find some of these classic kaiju movies on streaming services, which is, you know, what everyone, including me, has been really limited to lately. So it's been a treat watching these. So thank you very much for sharing them with me, Josh.
My pleasure. And because, again, I want others to know. So it's just...
Right. And I think I don't recall if we mentioned this on a different podcast, but God, do I wish that my law professors had used stuff like this as issue spotters rather than random abstract things. Alice walks into the store and Slim's like, no, I don't want to hear about that. I want you to give me an issue spotter of a kaiju movie.
Yes. Yes. Well, again, when we're law professors, we can totally do that.
Exactly.
Until that day, we're going to have to do it this way. So with that, everyone, continue to stay safe, stay healthy, and stay tuned for more. Thank you all.